All right, we had gotten about this far in our discussion of ion channels, and our discussion at this point about calcium channels. Just a quick review, we found that the pharmacology community is challenged in their understanding of the alphabet, but we could simplify things somewhat by dividing the ones that are in blue here, the high voltage activated channels, which there's many forms of, from the low voltage activated channels, which there's only one type of. The low voltage activated, or T-type, or transient, the T actually has some mnemonic value. If you look at the current that's generated, it's an inward current, of course. It comes on pretty rapidly, and it turns off pretty rapidly. So it's fast inactivation. The high voltage activated currents have a number of different properties in terms of their kinetics. The first one that was discovered, the high voltage activated L-type current, is a non-inactivating current. I showed you some data from some experiments we've done showing how persistent that current could be, and yet there are things that can block it. We're going to be talking about the pharmacology of blockers in a few moments. The N-type currents, if it had some mnemonic value, that would be a non-inactivating, but it's not. They just went to the next available letter in the alphabet that seemed convenient. It's a slow inactivating type current. It does turn off, but it does so slowly. And in fact, all the other types of high voltage activated currents also are slowly inactivating. So the N, P, and Q, and R types are all slowly inactivating. So if you kind of chunk it into these different categories, it simplifies things for you a bit. Is that clear to everyone? And if you get into the molecular biology of it, they have different names. The L types are the CaV1s. Ca again for calcium, V for voltage dependent. You know, the first type. The T types, they've been named in any sensible fashion, would have been CaV2s, but they're not. They're CaV3s. And then the others, the N, P, Q, and Rs, are all within the CaV2 family. If you get interested into the evolutionary biology of it, you can look at their lineage and the linkage between their structural similarities. Not going to hold you responsible for that sort of thing. Okay, so let's look at the pharmacology now. The sorts of things that block calcium channels. Multiple different types of sources. Nature has designed a lot of different things to target these channels. It's usually a clue that they have some important biological function. There's lots of things targeting them. Not the best designed classroom, is it? Okay. You've probably seen some of these sorts of organisms before. This one you, of course, have to look through a microscope. Lots of ways to target these types of channels. All right, quickly memorize everything on this chart. Now, at this point, again, let's simplify it and break it down so that it actually makes sense to you. Of course, again, I'm never going to hold you responsible for the chemical structure of any of these. But let's break down the types of drugs, the types of ligands that interact with these different types of channels. Again, let's look at that alphabetical information. Start with the L-type channels. Okay. First major category of drugs that interact with them are known as dihydropyridines. Dihydropyridines. If you're interested in the structure, this is a typical dihydropyridine structure up top. Double ring structure. The ones that are most clinically relevant within that category are a couple of drugs shown here. Nifedipine and nimodipine. Notice that suffix on them, dipine. Dipine, anything that ends in dipine is a dihydropyridine. Nifedipine is widely used for treatment of various cardiovascular disorders. Inability to regulate heart rate properly, blood pressure problems. Nimodipine has the interesting feature that it has a very high affinity for receptors in the cerebrovasculature, the blood supply to the brain. And hence, as neuroscientists, should be particularly interesting to you. It also has direct access to the nervous system because it's one of the dihydropyridines that has the highest lipophilicity. It crosses the blood-brain barrier very readily. In a number of studies we've done in the past, we can infuse it peripherally, and it has direct effect on neurons in the central nervous system. Among others. Among others. Okay. So it readily crosses the blood-brain barrier and affects calcium channels in the nervous system, L-type calcium channels, blocking them. There are several other clinically relevant families of L-type calcium channel blockers. The allele alkylamines, the primary one of which that you'll ever see if you're ever writing prescriptions in the future, is verapamil. Verapamil, large number of prescriptions written for that drug. The benzothiazepines, primary one of those is diltiazem. Diltiazem, and again, mostly these are targeted for their effect on the cardiovascular system. Those do not readily cross the blood-brain barrier. And finally, a more recently discovered family, some alkaloid compounds are produced in plants. The one that's actually hit the market is called Floritin. Floritin. Again, used for blood pressure regulation primarily. Okay, so those are all L-type calcium channel blockers. And we have a number of different types of blockers for the transient channels, the T-type channels. Again, were these high voltage activated or low voltage activated? Low voltage activated. The one that's most relevant, the only one on the list that you probably would be well served to learn at this point in time is flunarizine. Flunarizine. Going down the alphabet, should have gone L, M, they don't like O or zero. To the N-type channels, again, were these fast inactivating or slow inactivating or medium?
Slow.
Okay. N-type. General category are what we call conotoxins. I forgot to bring my little show and tell, a cone snail. They're actually an aquatic animal. Look really pretty. If you ever see one crawling around, don't touch it, or it will be the last thing you probably ever touch. Extremely toxic. Who can read the name of this toxin to me? Volunteer, say it out loud. You get better than some people would. You have to learn to read the hodgepodge of the alphabet that pharmacologists use. Omega, the Greek letter omega. The CTX stands for conotoxin, the way pharmacologists would abbreviate that. Omega conotoxin. G, not B, 6. We have to shift to Roman numbers. A. About as much of a hodgepodge as you could possibly come up with. Omega conotoxin G6A. Has to do with the particular structure of that peptide toxin, the order in which they discovered them, the order in which they happened to lay them down on the lab bench when they were working with them. And this is the most potent of the ones to block N-type calcium channels. N-type. If you see this used in an experimental paper, they're targeting the N-type channels. Omega conotoxin G6A. If you say GVIA, that shows you're a newbie. All right, continuing along those lines, some more peptide toxins. In this case, coming from a family of spiders, funnel web spiders, so-called agatoxins. Agatoxins, the one that's primarily used experimentally. You know a little bit about the naming scheme now. Omega agatoxin 1A. It's the most potent of the ones that have been looked at. As you notice, there's lots of other members of the family, but just learning the one is more than sufficient. Omega agatoxin 1A blocks both P and Q type channels. Then we move down to toxins that come from tarantula spiders. This one sort of violates my rule about letter number combinations. You really don't want to learn the full name for this. SNX-482 blocks the last remaining of the high voltage activated, slow inactivating channels, the R-type channels. SNX-482. There are lots and lots of other peptide toxins. I just put a few examples here. Don't expect you to remember thousands of other toxins that we now know of. But there's one other category that's important to know about. That's inorganic blockers. Inorganic blockers, basically things that come from mineral sources. Other ions. When we're talking about calcium channels, probably the one that's most widely used to block calcium channels is magnesium ions. Relatively cheap. Even more potent, typically, is cadmium ions. The cadmium is more expensive, so not as widely used. Also, cesium and nickel ions are very effective. And if you get really interested in the chemistry, you start looking at your periodic table of the calcium and then various other light metals around it. So we've covered all the different types of channels. If you don't want to get real specific, go with inorganic ions. They block all the types of calcium channels. If you want to target just one specific one, go with a more specific blocker. If you want to cease function of the nervous system, block them all. Block them with a high concentration. Probably not something you'd ever want to do in a clinical practice. Hopefully not. All right, we also have a category of drugs that actually enhance calcium channel function rather than block it. These are sometimes miscalled agonists because these aren't really receptors, these are ion channels. These ligands do bind to specific sites on the protein, but these aren't considered to be receptors, because these are not endogenous substances that are being produced to target these particular protein structures. Again, this is some experimental data published almost 20 years ago now. If you look at a normal L-type calcium channel current, non-inactivating, high-voltage activated current, and apply the drug Vacay 8644. Again, one of these that violates the letter member rule. It's a proprietary compound owned by the buyer company, which made aspirin famous. You can greatly enhance the amount of calcium coming in through those channels.
BK8644. Owned by the buyer company, their K division, and it was the 8,644th compound patented by that division of the company. Terrible reason to give a thing a name like that. It was proposed to put this in clinical trials. The first patient had a heart attack, never went beyond that. There are some peptide toxins, this particular one called mitotoxin. Mitotoxin, sounds like something Mighty Mouse might use. Mitotoxin enhances all the different types of calcium channels. BK is specific just to L-type channels. And one final piece of the puzzle. You ever read in the literature about calcium channel studies? Most often you will see that they're not actually looking at calcium channels, or at least at calcium currents. In most cases, experimentally, they substitute another ion, barium ions, as the charge carrier. Any good guesses why? Pardon? Same charge. It's bigger, so why would bigger be better?
More force.
More force? Nope. Bigger might be worse because the channel might not allow a bigger ion to pass through. Is it radioactive? Not the form, the isotopes that they usually use for this purpose. You can't have isotopes that are. No, they're the same charge. It's a real easy answer, folks. What does calcium do inside of neurons? Causes lots of enzymatic activity. How about barium? Have we talked about barium-regulated enzymes?
Nope.
So this avoids all those different second messenger effects. Just looks just at the ion channel-related effects. So it gives you a more controlled experiment. Remember the other half of the name of the degree you're working on? Science. When you do experiments, you should like to have proper controls. If you just use calcium, you're going to have lots of secondary effects of the calcium. So if you'd like to study the current in more isolation, you can substitute something like barium. Then you need to compare it back to the raw calcium current under other controlled conditions. But it's a very nice experimental substitution. Remember we talked about IV curves?
Here again is an example of an IV curve. Okay, with 0 millivolts here, we could put that axis on here if we wanted. The voltage is on the x-axis, right? On the y-axis. Larger inward deflection will be a larger curve here. This is high voltage activated currents. It's the maximal current is somewhere out in the very depolarized range. A low voltage activated current would be somewhere over leftward shift. In the low voltage range. Small movement away from the resting potential. This requires a large movement away from the resting potential. And it's a very good way to show the effect of each of these different potentials. Control condition, the amount of current. If the drug applied, the amount of current. Again, you should understand IV curves. They're very important. All right, that's not it for today. That's it for the first part of ion channels.
Playing with your mind? The second part, and we'll see how far we get with this today. We also have Thursday to talk about this as well. Hyperpolarizing channels. And I put hyperpolarizing, I should have put hyperpolarizing in quotes there, because that has several different meanings, as we'll see. These types of channels are a little more complicated than the depolarizing channels we've talked about. Okay, a lot more complicated than the depolarizing channels we've talked about. Start with the simple information. Two types of ion species involved. We're going to talk about proteins that gate chloride channels and those that gate potassium channels. Chloride and potassium. Okay.
Chloride, cation or anion?
Anion.
Anion, negatively charged.
Valence of 4, 8, 12. Valence of 1, 1 positive, 1 negative charge. Potassium ions, cation or anion?
Cation.
If it helps you, the T in cat looks like a plus sign. The N in anion looks like negative. If you haven't had organic or introductory chemistry yet, hopefully you have.
Chloride channels are the simpler of the two. They're going to hyperpolarize the membrane. What kind of current will we have? Inward or outward current?
Inward
current. We look at the IV curves. It looks something like this. Plus the resting potential, very strong inward current. We get up towards a depolarized potential. Actually undergoes a change and reverses. The very positive potentials, it's an outward current. That still brings the membrane back towards the resting potential. Moving these negatively charged ions inside the cell at hyperpolarized potentials makes it more negative. At depolarized potentials, we get the reverse, called the reversal potential when the current changes. How about potassium channels? In most cases, if we look at single channel records, we'll see potassium currents that look something like this. Starting from the resting potential, or zero current here, when the potassium channel opens, we'll see channel activity that looks like that. Inward or outward current flow?
Outward. For most potassium channels, but not for all of them. We'll look at exceptions to that in a moment. So it will be an upward current by the convention we're using here. It's used throughout the literature as well. Not a downward current, but an upward or outward current. Let's go through the simpler of the currents first. Chloride currents and pharmacology for them.
Clinically, there's three different sets of drugs that are used to block chloride channels. One, if you can't remember what this one does, your next exam is probably hopeless. Chlorotoxin. If you just had to guess from seeing that name on a piece of paper, you'd probably guess that it has something to do with chloride. Chlorotoxin blocks chloride channels. Actually comes from the number of species of scorpions. Chlorotoxin. There's a synthetic drug, flufenamate. Flufenamate is fairly widely used. lots of other relatives of it. And then one that's widely used for a different purpose, but is also very good at blocking chloride channels. Tamoxifen. Tamoxifen. Anybody know the primary clinical use of tamoxifen? For blocking estrogen receptors in breast cancer patients. Breast tumors are particularly sensitive to estrogen levels and causes increased proliferation. So the primary clinical use of tamoxifen is as an adjunct to other types of chemotherapy, but it's also a very good chloride channel blocker. And that one comes from a plant.
What are the side effects?
Side effects?
Yeah, besides shrinking the breast.
Oh, various ovarian issues, hormonal issues, large number of side effects. So if you were looking just for the chloride channel effects, probably better to choose one of these others that's more specific just for that target. Too many chloride channels are blocked, neurons depolarize. So they don't have their normal function. Okay. All right, three different kinds of blockers to remember for chloride channels. You're going to wish it was this small a number for potassium channels. Potassium channels, again, a very large number of different sources for blockers. Nature produces lots. Humans have added to that list very extensively. Again, when there's lots of things targeting a particular target in the nervous system or in cells, pretty good clue that that's something that's very important to normal function. And that disturbing that function can have profound consequences. If, for instance, you're a rattlesnake and target these, it makes it easier to get your next meal. If you're a scorpion, it might make it easier to get your next meal, or it might prevent you from becoming a meal. Same for bacteria and plants. Probably more likely to make it less likely you'll become a meal in the latter cases. Now, we've talked about action potentials before. You're probably pretty familiar looking at action potentials. But what most people forget very often is that even if we're ramping up to the depolarizing event where we trigger the threshold for firing of the action potential, we're also activating potassium currents. Potassium currents help determine the resting potential of the neuron. As soon as we move away from the resting potential, we activate some very early types of potassium channels. Ones that are very sensitive to the very small movement away from the resting potential. It includes IA and ID. We'll be looking at those in more detail in a minute. When we get to the peak of the action potential, sodium channels have come on and gotten to that peak. And what do sodium channels do at that peak? Are they still active?
No.
They've inactivated. The membrane potential would stay up there if it wasn't for potassium currents. Something needs to bring the membrane potential back down. Particularly the class of potassium currents that we call IK, the K-type channels. Bring things back down to the resting potential. In fact, very often below the resting potential to what we call the after hyperpolarizations. And then there's a number of different ways that we can modulate after currents. Calcium-dependent potassium currents, the earliest of which that's typically activated is called IC. IC continues to be active later, and we start adding in other types I am median AHP current, what we call IAHP. And that one stays persistent in some neurons for longer periods. And then a still more persistent one, the one we call slow AHP currents. And that's a lot to absorb off of this slide. I'm very cognizant of that, very aware of that. So we're going to break it down in various different ways. Hopefully, one or more of those ways will enable you to remember all of this. Okay? This is to illustrate, though, that at different times during action potential firing, we'll have a large number of potassium currents participating as well and shaping what we see as that action potential. Shaping the membrane response to a depolarizing event. And if you notice, it's only for this brief period of time that we have this extremely large depolarization. The rest of the time, we're operating down near the resting potential, or even more negative than the resting potential. Is that clear to everybody? And in my own lab, I'm particularly interested in these things that can modulate the after potentials, the types of potassium channels involved. All right, a lot on this slide. Unfortunately, you need to be able to remember everything here. So we're going to take our time on this. There's four different major categories of potassium channels, four major ones. Shown 1, 2, 3, 4. Then these categories, there's typically four members of those. It's more complicated though, because some types of currents fit more than one category. Let's break it down one by one. Let's start with the ones that were discovered first, back by Hodgkin and Huxley, recording from squid giant axons with electrodes that looked much like paper clips. Did not take extremely high tech in those days to do neurophysiology with squid giant axons. The so-called classic voltage-dependent channels. They're voltage-dependent potassium channels, so we call them VDKCs. VD not for venereal disease, but for voltage-dependent, K for potassium channels. Those include the currents that we call IA, ID, IK, and IM. You change the membrane voltage in a depolarizing direction, you will activate those types of channels. IA, ID, IK, and IM. We'll look at those in more detail and blockers for them in just a moment. Which one do you think was discovered first? IA. That would be a good guess, and in this particular case, you'd get lucky. And that'd be correct. Then we have what are called the rectifier channels. Rectifier loosely from the Latin root to make right, to rectify. What's the right or proper potential for a neuron? It's another phrase we use for that. The resting potential. These help determine the resting potential of the neuron. When the action potential has gotten the potential way far away, the major current that brings it back to right, to rectification, is IK. A couple others that are kind of weird. We're going to look at them and their weirdness in a minute. One of them, you got a clue that there's something weird. It's called the anomalous rectifier. Anomalous rectifier. Horrible name. Actually gives you a clue. It's strange. Doesn't act like other potassium currents. Then we have another one that unfortunately has two names. In America, socially, we're fairly homophobic. So you might think this stands for the homophobic current. It was originally named in England, where it was called IQ. Because in England, the word queer has a different meaning than it does here. Their queer meant something like anomalous, strange. In England, saying something is gay means it was happy. And if you ask for a cigarette, they'll look blankly at you. So the English language has many variants. In America, if we talked about something being queer, there would be political overtones to that. So we call this the hyperpolarization activated channel. So H doesn't stand for homophobic, it stands for hyperpolarization activated potassium channel. But anywhere but in America, it's called IQ. Doesn't stand for intelligence quotient in that sense. Maybe it is a comment on our general intelligence level, though. Hard to say. And then finally, a fairly recently discovered category of rectifier channels, tandem poor. Tandem poor. And this one, again, is weird. Almost every other kind of ion channel we know of has one pore, one channel, one region that ions can pass through. How many do you think a tandem pore channel has?
Two.
Have you ever heard of a tandem bicycle? Bicycle built for two. Tandem pore channels give you twice the potassium current per activation of any other potassium channel. Tandem pore. Those turn out to be particularly important for the effects of volatile anesthetics. If you ever want to go in for surgery, tandem pore channels. Okay, next major category, metabotropic gated channels. Have we heard about anything metabotropic previously? Second messenger systems, particularly kinases and phosphatases. These might be sensitive to the effects of those different pathways. The first one in this category is called IM, for one of the categories of acetylcholine receptors, the muscarinic type of receptors. And the second messenger cascade kicked off by them. But remember, they're also sensitive, not just to metabotropic, but also to voltage. And in fact, as we'll see in a moment, they also have calcium sensitivity. How about this substance? Is it ever present in cells? ATP? Better be, or you'd all be dead. ATP-sensitive potassium channels. These other categories, IAHP, not to be confused with I-slow AHP. We're starting to run out of names here. AHP and slow AHP. Very sensitive to phosphorylation, but in fact even more sensitive in the fourth category to calcium. So the fourth category, calcium-dependent channels, includes one other we haven't mentioned so far. Might be a useful mnemonic, IC, for calcium-dependent. Generates very large currents. Then IM, the muscarin-sensitive current. very sensitive to calcium as well. And then the last two, the major contributions after hyperpolarizations, IAHP for after hyperpolarization, and slow AHP for slow after hyperpolarization. Again, if we're looking at the currents generated by many of these are inward or outward currents. Going up, what's that give you a clue to? Outward currents. In this case, these are voltage dependent. So when we displace the membrane voltage, we generate these strong outward currents. Differences in them are going to be how fast they inactivate. This one, pretty much non-inactivating. Would this be called non-inactivating? Really fast inactivating. How about these? Slow inactivating. Similar to the descriptions we use for calcium currents. All right, let's use what we've talked about so far. When we talked about calcium currents, we looked at their protein structure. We saw that they had four transmembrane segments. I'm sorry, four subunits, each with six transmembrane segments. And we see that the voltage-dependent potassium channels have a very similar structure. Four subunits with six transmembrane segments each. Protein chemists would look at it this way. Most people would look at them in the assembled form in the membrane. Looks real similar to a calcium channel. Okay. Again, the voltage-dependent ones, IA, ID, IK, and IM. When you depolarize the cell, these become active. How about the other types of ion channels that had a similar structure? What did they do when you depolarize the membrane? Inactivate or become active? Calcium channels, sodium channels. What do they do when you depolarize the membrane? Say it out loud. They become active. That's their activation kinetics. Depolarization activates them. Same for these voltage-dependent potassium channels, but they do something opposite to the membrane potential. By moving these positive charges out instead of in, they bring the membrane potential back to rest. That should not be a hard question, folks. Membrane potential activates these. Depolarization of the membrane potential activates these. In fact, a lot is known about this, and fairly recently a neuroscientist won the Nobel Prize for looking at the molecular mechanism for activation of potassium channels, the voltage-dependent ones. This is looking at the channel from above, and a potassium ion hypothetically moving through that channel. And it turns out a movement of a very small portion of the molecular structure opens that channel up. Remember earlier when we talked about sodium channels and calcium channels? Regional conformational change. Change in the relative shape of a small portion of the molecular structure is responsible for activation. Okay, remember when we talked about voltage-gated channels, they had three states. An open state, a closed state, and what was the other one?
There's a problem. Reniker says there's four.
Says there's four. What's he say is the fourth one?
Well, it's actually a combination of the regional confrontational and the block.
Yeah.
So closed inactive and open inactive. Yeah, I'm trying to keep it simple. Redeker's absolutely correct. I'm trying not to overwhelm people that haven't had neurophys yet. Okay, not a problem at all.
So here we just
Here, I think people have more than enough to absorb. Because Reniker's not going to throw all the drugs at you, too. He's going to add more complication onto the physiology side. Okay? All right, so this is the activation. How about inactivation of these? Again, we had fast inactivation, slow inactivation, non-inactivation. Turns out for these again, you have a blocking particle. Cartoon view, dangling down below. They close the open state of the channel. And then yes, Dr. Reniker's right. We go from an open blocked to a closed blocked state. And then just a closed state. So now you're going to be responsible for that. And again, we know a lot about the amino acid structure of that portion of the molecule. You can delete one or two amino acids and prevent that inactivation from occurring. Couple more seconds. You won't ever be asked to reproduce these diagrams, of course. Sure. Maybe Dr. Reniker will ask you to, though.
He sure loves that Hodgkin and Huxley box. He's
as well he should. It's appropriate for physiology.
Yes.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a question about the beta cell
chemistry. They block the ability to move outward. Efflux. Happens on the inside of the membrane, just like it does for the sodium channels or calcium channels. In this case, the ions are moving in the opposite direction. Okay. Now let's look at some pharmacology for these different classes of voltage-dependent channels, the BDKCs. And remember, there's four of them, IA, ID, IK, and IM. If you get really interested in it and you want to know the molecular biology names, again, molecular biologists didn't pay any attention to neuroscientists or to other physiologists or pharmacologists, named them in the order they wanted to. This would have made sense if this was KV1, but this turned out to be the first one they studied. So they called that one KV1. This one ended up being KV4, even though it was the first known type of potassium channel. Second known one, randomly, they happened to also name KV2. How about this one? Does it have any of those numbers? Nope. Weird alphabetical combinations, KCN, Q, even though it has nothing to do with the Q current. Molecular biologists like to make our life complicated. I say that as a physiologist. If you notice the activation kinetics of these, three of the four are low voltage activated. There's only one that's high voltage activated. The IKs. That's the one that comes on when the membrane potential is shooting up very strongly depolarized. All the others are active down in the range close to the resting potential. Low voltage activated. Where they differ is in their inactivation now. The high voltage activated one is also slowly inactivated, the K's. That's probably a good thing because it comes on while the resting potential is going up during the action potential rising phase. It stays on to drive it back down during the declining phase of the action potential. The other one's IA, comes on real early. It also goes off real quickly. Fast inactivating. This is what the IA current looks like. Comes on quickly, turns off quickly. ID comes on a little more slowly, not much, stays on longer. It's considered slowly or medium inactivating. Medium to sort of distinguish it from this one that is even slower, the IK. And IM, non-inactivating. So you can keep track of them by their activation and inactivation kinetics. And it's all in your textbook if you lose all your notes. I put activators on here. I think we'll ignore those for now. It's more than enough pharmacology just to look at the blockers for these channels.
Is that the ingredient Rogaine?
Minoxidil
thing?
Yep. Yep. Look at blockers. DTX stands for dendrotoxin. Part of the neuron you think that would affect. Dendrites. Dendrotoxin affects all of these, IA, ID, and IK. It has no effect on IM. So dendrotoxin would affect the ones that come on as you start to depolarize the cell, and then affect the repolarization of the action potential. Dendrotoxin. It might seriously screw up neuronal function. Dendrotoxin. Unfortunately, it's really expensive. It's really good at doing that. Experimentally, you're more likely to see these two drugs. Or aminopyridine. And this one, if you walk into any barbecue joint in Texas, you want to be sure you don't get served this particular drug, TEA, because it doesn't come in a sweet form and unsweetened form. It stands for tetraethyl ammonium. Tetraethyl ammonium. TEA. If you serve that in a barbecue place, you probably won't walk out the door. Tetraethyl ammonium. Those are most commonly used experimentally to block these three classes of potassium channels. They have limited specificity depending on their concentration. So at low concentration, aminopyridine mostly targets IA. As you increase the concentration, it begins to have effect on the other voltage-dependent channels. Tetraethyl ammonium works in the reverse fashion. Lower concentrations, mostly effects on IK. Step the concentration up, start to affect the other types of voltage-gated channels. Just like with the calcium channels, you have inorganic ions can block. Cesium is the one that is most effective at blocking all the voltage-dependent potassium channels, cesium ions. Finally, we have blockers for this one. For IM. Remember, IM is in several categories. So linopyridine, the drug that's widely used, very specific just to the M channels. Not the muscarinic receptors, but to the ion channels that are affected by muscarinic receptors. Muscarinic receptors themselves respond to muscarinic agonists. And when those are activated, that blocks the IM channels. The second messenger cascades that are kicked off block those channels. So these are called muscarin-sensitive receptors, or channels, sorry.
The TEA is not for ID, is that supposed to be micro or?
TEA for ID.
Is it an implicit? Is that supposed to be 100 micro?
No, it should be millimolar. Thank you. Yeah, it should be new and more. So again, to keep track of which is which, high voltage activated or low voltage activated? Which one's high voltage activated? IK is high voltage activated. Then we also need to keep track of their inactivation. Non-inactivating varieties of slow inactivation or really fast. I think we'll go through rectifiers and that'll be enough for today. Okay? Rectifying channels, the ones that help move things around the resting potential. The structures are odd. Every one of them is different within this category. Some of them have four subunits, but only two transmembrane segments each. Tandem pores have that four transmembrane segment structure, but that makes one whole pore. And two of those co-assemble as a dimer to make the native channel, the tandem pore channel. If one unit is a monomer, what is a dimer? Two. What's a trimer? Okay, or a quaterer? So on. The way that they're found natively in membranes is as dimers. So this is the structure for the anomalous rectifier. It ends up looking functionally like some of the others, but simpler in its structure. Tandem pores, the dimer, forms two of those columnar sorts of organizations.
This would be one complete subunit, the monomer. The dimer would be two of that set of monomers. Again, they'll assemble in a columnar fashion like that. But when they're expressed in the membrane, you'll always get a dimer form.
So it's eight transmembrane?
So it'd be eight total transmembrane segments.
Let's look a little bit at the pharmacology as well as the physiology of these rectifying channels. Remember this one we've already talked about, IK. It was the only one of the high voltage activated voltage sensitive channels. It was slowly inactivating. There were a number of different blockers. One real good cheap one was cesium. Now let's look at these two weird ones in the middle. One of them, the name gives you a clue it's weird, the anomalous rectifier. The other one in America we call IH. What did that mean, IH? What did the H stand for? Not homophobic. Hyperpolarization activated. Okay, both of these, the anomalous rectifier and IH, don't follow the normal voltage-dependent rules, but they are voltage-dependent.
They're not activated by depolarization. What are they activated by? Hyperpolarization. When the membrane potential becomes more negative than the resting potential. That's weird. No other kind of ion channels are activated by hyperpolarization. These bring the membrane potential back to the resting potential when it becomes too negative. And when that happens, we open up the ion channels and get an inward potassium current, an inward movement of potassium ions. Again, that's weird. All the other potassium channels give us an outward current. What happens when we're, say, below minus 70? We're at minus 80 millivolts. The rest of the membrane potential. And we open up ion channels and move positive charges inside the membrane. What does that do to the membrane potential? Depolarizes it, brings it back to the resting potential. These are only active in that hyperpolarized range. You get back to the resting potential, they shut off. So they don't depolarize the membrane beyond that point. They bring the membrane potential back up to rest when it's been down in that negative range. So the anomalous rectifier and IH, or in any other country, IQ, carries out that function. And finally, we have the one we have an entire specialty in medical practice devoted to, anesthesiology, major tool in their technical arsenal these days. The tandem pore potassium channels. Most textbooks don't even understand how they work. Only fairly recently discovered. Usually takes textbooks more than 5 or 10 years to catch up with the field. Hopefully the next edition of some of our books will. Notice the names for these channels that molecular biologists have given them. The voltage-gated ones, they were pretty simple. The KVs, voltage-dependent potassium channels. These, at least, if you saw KIR, you might know what that meant. Irregular anomalous rectifier. Also known as the inward rectifier. Inward rectifier. Don't think bad thoughts. IH, they're called HCN. But look at the names the molecular biologists have given to the tandem pores. The newer ones. Thick, thack, talk, track, trek, twick. They haven't finished with the whole family yet. The T stands for tandem and the K stands for potassium. The others all have weird other acronyms. One nice thing, since you're having to remember things, look at the inactivation kinetics. All of these rectifiers are all the same. Slow inactivated. Whole category. No fast, no non. All slow. One category that's important here is for the tandem pores, activators. Ligands that turn these channels on. That's pretty much every volatile anesthetic we know of. For humans, that might include drugs like isoflurane, still occasionally used for humans. Sevoflurane, more commonly used these days. Old days, they used drugs like halothane or ether. Ether had the disadvantage it would blow up. Halothane had the disadvantage it would kill your liver.
Probably not if you just had one surgery, but if you were the anesthesiologist, then you'd die of liver failure. Anesthesiologists decided they didn't like that, switched over to safer drugs. Problem with volatile anesthetics is when it's to activate these channels, twice as much hyperpolarization as you get with other passing channels. There's nothing to turn them back off. We have no known blockers for those tentative poor channels. So if the anesthesiologist doesn't pay attention, passes too much gas, it's not a fart joke. Gives the patient too much gas, the depth of anesthesia goes too low, they can't clear the drug out by giving another drug. They've got to artificially respirate the patient so their lungs will breathe it back out. And they got to keep the heart going to get the blood circulated through the rest of the body and get the rest of the drug that's gone through the rest of the body back out. And for them to wake up, they've got to maintain the cerebral blood flow to get it back out of the nervous system. It would be nice if you could just give them a simple injection and reverse it. Can't be done. It's one of the reasons why anesthesiologists have such high malpractice insurance rates. It's easy to screw up and not good fixes for the mess up. For all the other rect design channels, we do have good blockers. The ones that are most commonly used, simple inorganic blockers like cesium. So based on this slide, how many of you are going to go into anesthesiology? N of one. Okay. Be prepared. If you read up about general anesthetics in textbooks, they'll usually give you wrong information. They'll talk about membrane fluidity and things of that sort. Completely bogus stuff. I think that'll be enough for today. We'll go on from here.